Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Unmanned System ISR Sensor Payload Innovation Through Signal Processing. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Val Zaroff, Director of Program Management for Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions, David French, Director of Business Development at GE Intelligent Platforms, and Roger Hosking, Vice President and Co-Founder of Pentek. Now, before we get started, I have some short housekeeping announcements. This eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. I also want to point out three very important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to send an email of request for this event. The third button on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a specific question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand up the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event. And now please turn over to our first speaker, Val. Take it away.
Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining this event today. My name is Val Zaroff. I'm Director of Engineering and Program Management at Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions. I'd like to start by giving you some background on our leadership in this market space. As illustrated in the bottom half of the slide, with some representative examples, we have extensive experience delivering SWaP-C optimized systems to a number of premier UAS platforms, which includes sensor management systems, flight control computers, data recorders, and signal processing solutions of various sizes and power densities. Every system is built rugged from ground up, leveraging COTS products. UAS platforms are gaining more popularity and seeing an increased demand executing various missions. The need for multiple and various types of sensors that capture high bandwidth data while executing longer missions is outgrowing physical UAS platform capacity from swap and downlink bandwidth perspective. Sensor payload interconnect and data transfer complexity has significantly increased over the last 15 years. Continuous and fast-paced electronic component and interface development growth resulted in a variety of implementation options for sensors and sensor management solutions. Systems designers today are faced with a supermarket challenge in deciding processor architectures, form factors, interface fabrics, and operating systems, many choices and multiple possible solutions. Electronic component development fuels similar growth of choices and options at the subsystem level. What you see at the top is a typical ISR sensor management computer architecture, and below are the various subsystem choices available to a designer. What used to be a very basic sensor architecture, for example, a single device connected directly to a downlink communication unit, has become a complex interconnect of multiple high-speed sensors joined at the sensor management system. The need for optimization at every processing and interface stage is required to avoid data bottlenecks, minimize latency, and limit bandwidth load on the downlink interface, resulting in the end-to-end optimization. Our experience with various sensor payload architecture points to a need to work closely together with software algorithm developers at the platform level when selecting the right combination of components for the most optimized system solution to facilitate end user requirement for quick relevant data availability with proper security level. On this slide, we show an example of system of systems approach to ISR sensor payload management. The problem is getting the right data to the right end user with lowest possible latency and proper security. There's a lot of sensor data available on board the UAV, and the typical solution to the problem has been to use raw preprocessing power, further challenging the SWaP-C requirement, or to try to offload raw data via downlink to a ground-based processing center. In this particular example, and under a significant SWaP-C constraint, the solution was reached through achieving optimal balance between processing power and efficient data routing capability, coupled with a software feature set that enables real-time data access. From a takeaway perspective, what we at Curtiss-Wright are seeing today, a traditional brute force approach is not always the best solution when SWaP-C constraints are critical. In those cases, a better approach is to optimize hardware and software of the ISR sensor management architecture. The good news is all that is achievable today by using open architecture COTS technology that's currently available. For more information, please contact us via email link provided on the following slide. And I'll turn it back to you, John.
Thanks very much, Val. And just before I turn it over to David, I want to remind the audience that the Q&A session will start after our final speaker, Roger, is finished. So as you're thinking up your questions, get them ready, put them through so we can get to them as soon as Roger is done. And now for our next speaker, Mr. David French. David?
Thanks, John, for the introduction, and thank you, everybody, for joining the webcast. GE Intelligent Platform certainly appreciates everyone's interest and participation here, and we hope you find the material informative and useful. So considering the requirements for unmanned aircraft ISR payload signal processing, we see a consistent demand for more onboard processing capacity. Sensor solutions are driving more data into the computing platforms. The data needs to move within the platform quickly, leveraging high-speed interconnects and delivering higher data rates. These are things like 40 gig E, InfiniBand, PCI Express. And the only architectures that can now really support these performance requirements are open architecture, multi and mini core computing solutions, high performance clusters. So most of the UAS payload types that GE supports have similar requirements in that they are large, highly parallel data sets. And these could be things from radar platforms, EOIR, hyperspectral imaging, and various methods of modes of data fusion. GE high-performance embedded computing solutions take directly from solutions in the big iron high-performance computing domain. This provides very scalable, open, and continuous development model that scales across multiple HPC configurations. So applications developed in the lab can directly translate to embedded development and deployable solutions. So we have high-performance, low-latency clusters, open standard middlewares, again, leveraging the high-performance big iron market, common APIs across all these different platforms and deployable options, and a large software development community, including CUDA, for GPGPU computing. So we end up with a continuous application development model that's very flexible in taking applications developed in lab environments and deploying them to the field. GE has access to the latest GPU CUDA processing technology through our OEM relationship with NVIDIA. Computing platforms today can deliver hundreds of gigaflops to teraflops of computing in relatively small form factor solutions, but generally requiring a healthy amount of power. The NVIDIA Tegra K1 system-on-chip GPGPU processor significantly changes this picture. It's the first ARM system-on-chip with an integrated GPU and CUDA support. So GE has recently announced some activity with this part, and this GPGPU computing solution brings the best small form factor solution with HPEC capabilities to UAS ISR processing. It directly applies to high-performance, power-constrained applications. So the high-level features here are pretty self-explanatory, but what's significant about this new capability is over 300 gigaflops for a mere 6 watts thermal design power. This level of computing capacity required tens to hundreds of watts just a few short years ago. The system on chip integrates a number of features that enable relatively complete solutions in a small form factor. Quad-core ARM, 192-core GPU, a PCIe root complex to extend the part for other applications and integrations, and again, common support across a variety of CUDA application developments. Because the GPGPU processor offsets dramatic performance per watt capabilities, GE will be providing the first solution in a rugged COM Express form factor. All classes or groups of unmanned aircraft can gain significant advantage here, but it is particularly compelling for the Group 1, 2, and 3 UAVs. These are the smaller class of UAVs. This particular part will be available in extended temperature environments, all starter parts for rugged environments will be deployed and qualified in those standard A10 environments. It's a game changer. So the following illustrates some possible ways to extend the platform solution, integrating on custom baseboards, for instance, or other modules. So sensors can be added through the built-in PCI Express root complex, for instance. Multiple sensors on Ethernet interconnects can be aggregated alongside other sensor interfaces. The options now provided in levels of performance per watt become quite interesting in proposed tile solutions. The performance here is somewhat theoretical, but just achieving over a teraflop in a solution that is less than 50 watts and a few pounds opens up a number of very interesting possibilities in UAS ISR payload processing. Again, it's a game changer. So we talked about code compatibility, and again, there is code compatibility from the highest performance platforms to the smallest. The same CUDA and Linux code can be deployed across all these solutions. So GPGPU computing scales, which enables software reuse, leveraging existing UAS ISR application development across multiple unmanned aircraft platforms and domains. So thanks for everybody's time. I'll give it back to you, John.
Thanks, David. And I'll tell the audience to keep those questions coming in. And now for our final speaker, Mr. Roger Hosking of Pentek. Roger?
Thanks for the intro, John, and welcome everybody today to our presentation. What we're going to do is take a look. Let's see. Get the slides right here. I think we're going to go to my first slide. How's that? Okay. As you may know, Pentek has been supplying board-level products for high-speed data acquisition and signal processing for more than 25 years now. And what we're going to do today is we're going to focus on some specific technologies that we've been using most recently to attack getting these sensors coupled into a processing element, typically an FPGA, and then connecting through to the system for the rest of the job. So what we're going to look at today is looking at how different strategies are being applied for this to this problem. And, for example, how do you get more DSP resources to handle the higher bandwidths and the greater number of channels? How do you do faster digitizing for the A to Ds and D to As to accommodate those wider bandwidth signals? And then how do you, once digitized, translate those wideband signals down to baseband to extract a particular slice of the signal that you're looking at for decoding, demodulation, or storage? You also have to eliminate bottlenecks between the boards and between components on the boards to make sure that you can achieve the data flow you need. You need large and fast DRAM and SRAM buffers for capturing transients, for handling these wider bandwidth signals. And extremely important, especially on unmanned vehicles, is the ability to reconfigure the application that's running without having to bring the system down. So easy reconfigurability is a real plus for these applications. And then lastly, we're going to look at some new technology that's based on a new backplane optical I/O standard for the VPX. So first of all, in terms of addressing the increased DSP resources, we're going to take a look at how the Xilinx series of parts for the Vertex family have evolved over the last four generations. Here we're looking at the Vertex 4, the number of logic cells in a particular device based on a smaller or a larger density device. As we move into the Vertex 5, you see more resources, Vertex 6 even more, and the Vertex 7, of course, much more. And this is all in the same footprint, the same size package. This has been achieved primarily by reducing the geometry of the cells from 90 nanometers down to 28 nanometers. But one of the nice things, especially important for the unmanned vehicles, is that a given function in the Vertex 6 technology will, when translated to Vertex 7, only consume about half the power. So this is a major benefit for these types of systems. One example of a wideband digitizer is our 3.6 gigahertz A to D converter module. This is an XMC module that takes advantage of the Vertex 7 to receive the very high-speed data that's flowing from the A to D converter. It's supported with multi-channel, multi-board synchronization features, and it operates in two modes. In the single-channel mode, you can use it as a 3.6 gigahertz single-channel 12-bit A to D converter, digitizing up to 1.5 gigahertz bandwidths and usable for RF inputs up to about 1.8 gigahertz. But it can also be used in a two-channel mode where you can have two 1.8 gigasample per second A to D converters, 12 bits, in the same device just by throwing a software switch. This, by digitizing at such a high speed, may in fact eliminate the need for an analog RF tuner in your design. That could be a major benefit in terms of saving components and complexity. Lastly, there's a very high-speed PCI Gen 3 by 8 PCI Express interface that moves data at up to 8 gigabytes per second to the rest of the system. To accommodate the down conversion, we have also installed a very wideband digital down converter in the FPGA. This is the fastest digital down converter in the industry. It actually uses a polyphase design with eight parallel 450 megahertz DDCs operating in tandem. You can tune the input anywhere from 0 to 3.6 gigahertz, translating a slice of the spectrum down to baseband IQ with bandwidths from 90 to 360 megahertz, then ready for additional signal processing. And again, we have full multi-board synchronization that supports multi-element phased arrays for beamforming, direction finding, and diversity receivers. We also are using the PCI Express Gen 3 system interface that's provided in the Vertex 7. We're taking advantage of that. And we're using it with our own designs of chaining DMA controllers to make it very easy to move data from the FPGA out through across PCI Express to the rest of the system, again, at data rates up to 8 gigabytes per second. We also take advantage of very fast and very deep memory interfaces, now operating at transfer rates of 1,600 mega transfers per second. These 32-bit ports to each of the four banks of the SDRAMs can operate at 6.4 gigabytes per second for a total throughput between the FPGA and memory of 25.6 gigabytes per second. This is really great for capturing radar transients in real time or providing a digital RF memory for countermeasures and other applications. We've also enhanced the product and our Vertex 7 design with a feature called Gate Express. What the Gate Express does is it allows the host computer to completely reconfigure the entire FPGA as a simple software task. It's all done across the PCI Express interface, so that using a utility, the host computer can simply say, load this new bitstream image into the FPGA, and it's done as a software task. So this supports live runtime FPGA configuration without requiring a reboot and without requiring the device to come down. So it can support, for example, through a radio link, over-the-air reconfiguration of an FPGA inside of a UAV. And the other thing is, if the FPGA is reconfigured as a bitstream this way, there is no non-volatile storage of that sensitive bitstream in case that the device is captured. So these are really all major benefits for unmanned vehicles. We wanted to introduce a new optical backplane, and we have a nickname Flexor for this product, a trade name. It's based on our Vertex 7 XMC technology that we've looked at previously with all of the benefits of speeds and high-speed memory and PCI Express. But one thing we've added to this now is a VPX module itself, a VPX carrier that plugs into an open VPX system. This accepts an FMC module, and it also supports a new standard that's evolving at under the VITA specification of 66.4 for optical backplane interface between a plug-in module and the backplane. The way this works is that it uses a what's called an MT ferrule that accepts these optical pipes, optical fibers, that go into a two-piece connector system that is manufactured by at least two different manufacturers, TE and Molex. One half goes on the module, which you see down below, and then the other half goes into the backplane connector. These are blind-mate connectors with a metal housing that guides the connectors together, and then there are additional spring-loaded assemblies and alignment pins to make sure the ends of the two fibers, when mated, line up perfectly. At the other end of the optical cables, we're using what's called a Samtec Firefly optical MT transceiver. This is in the form of two modules that do the translation between the copper and the optical fibers that you see here. So each of those cables that you see coming out to the left, to the right rather, in that lower left picture, are actually flat ribbon cables consisting of 12 optical fibers. Each fiber or each lane is capable of delivering data at 14 gigabits per second. This supports both single and multimode fiber interfaces. When looking at the board from the backplane, you can actually see an end view of this shown here, where one half of the VPX P2 connector is removed and the VITA 66.4 connector replaces it. And you can actually see the end view of that here looking at it. This is, an option for VPX, but now fully defined in the VITA 66.4. Taking an overall look of the complete assembly, here you can see the FMC carrier, which has the FPGA on it. You see an FMC module, and then you see the Firefly modules going over to the backplane connector, and then the backplane itself is shown folded away. Each of these interfaces, then, with 12 lanes, can deliver up to 12 gigabytes per second to and from this across this backplane connection. It gives you some major advantages for very lightweight traffic and also very, very high speed. And the third major advantage, of course, is distance, several kilometers. So what we've done is looked at some of the new technologies that Pentek is using. We're taking full advantage of the Vertex 7 to get the additional DSP horsepower, faster PCI Express, faster memory, the lower power per function. And then we've added our own Pentek features, which include the down converter in the IP, the configuration manager called Gate Express, synchronization and triggering across multiple channels. And then our new Flexor product line, we've added the optical interface to this blend in a native 3U VPX carrier. So if you'd like to see some more information about any of these products, please visit us on the website, pentek.com. And now I'll turn it back over to John.
Thank you very much, Roger. Also, thank you, Val and David. So how about we get started on the Q&A? All right. Our first question from the audience is, I think, came in during Val's talk. Please distinguish between swap and swap C. It's a good question. I've come across instances where C stands for cost, and some people say it stands for cooling. Where do you stand?
This is Val. Thank you. We actually meant the cost aspect of it, so size, weight, power, and cost, is specifically addressing some of the constraints that are currently under the budgetary pressures from the U.S. market and some of the other foreign entities that are trying to procure UAVs. So this is becoming more and more important as this payload suites are becoming more diverse and different sensors are available, making sure that every time there's a new sensor, the integration costs are minimized and the cost becomes another element in the swap consideration.
Okay. Next question. In terms of hardware payload, have you implemented a similar package using a many-core Intel Atom system on chip and 1.2 gigabits per second wireless? I'm not sure if this is for David or for Val.
I believe this is for David.
David, you want to take it?
Yes, we have Intel Atom on COM Express form factor. On some of our larger form factors, we're typically sticking to the i7 architectures, but more recently we've done some work with actually AMD, which has some very interesting integrated technologies with GPU on board, as well as multi-core ARM processors.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Keep those questions coming in. Next question I have here is for Roger Hosking. Does the Vertex 7 really run cooler than the Vertex 6, the Xilinx FPGAs?
Function, if you take a particular function that is in operating in the Vertex 6 and you move that function to the Vertex 7, you definitely will run with less power. The trouble is that there are more resources in the Vertex 7, and so people tend to fill it back up so that it's using perhaps 50%, 70% more resources. So saving the power does not necessarily mean the device is going to run cooler.
Okay. Thank you, Roger. Next question from the audience. David, it looks like there's two questions here for you. One says you need a 10-watt solution. I don't know if that's a question or a statement. The other one is, what solution is 7 watts?
So the thermal design power on the the thermal design power on the part is in the 5 to 7 watt range. So when you end up integrating things like memories and PCI bridges and other physical interfaces onto, for instance, the COM Express form factor or an XMC, you're adding power. So the part itself has a 5 to 7 watt thermal design power, but in end design, it's fully integrated. And in a standard industry form factor, if you will, is going to be typically in the 10 watt range or even perhaps 15. But it's still a pretty significant delta in a performance per watt when you consider what you had to pay for power to get that kind of capability in the past.
Next question. This one would be for Val. What are the most interesting emerging technology trends for UAV-based ISR systems?
What we're seeing here is a convergence toward the open architecture, net-centric, IP-based payload management systems. And the trend here is really leading toward ensuring that we address the cost constraints of going from one suite to the other suite of different sensors. There is a significant integration cost every time you move a system from one platform to the other, or even within different families of a similar platform, that essentially drives up software reporting costs. And having open architecture is something that tends to gain a lot of traction nowadays from the a cost perspective and maintaining program schedule.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Next question from the audience. This one, I think, is just for anyone. Do you see practical application of this technology for medical devices, particularly related to remote patient monitoring? Anyone? I guess you're signal. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is David French. I think the challenge there probably is certification. When you ever get close to touching a patient, there are some pretty significant FDA certification requirements. Not that the technology couldn't apply, it could very well apply, but I think you need organizational capability around certifiability toward FDA. We focus on airborne customers where we've got things like flight safety certification or information assurance issues, which all have their own certification requirements. Medical applications that close and touch the patient, provide patient monitoring, have specific certifiability requirements attached to them. But that's not to say this wouldn't apply, but there are other issues that have to be addressed.
Thank you. Anybody else want to jump in? Or?
Yeah, hi, this is Roger. We definitely have our boards being used in medical systems. Again, they're typically not in live systems that are in contact with the patient, but actually doing things like functional MRI where there is a live subject that whose brain is being scanned, for example, in a 3D motion picture. The trouble is this is an extremely large, cumbersome system, and it really is not anything like any of the smaller systems we've been talking about today. I guess the point is that the technology that we've presented today is usable in a lot of different areas of industry, both government and commercial.
Thanks, Roger. Next question from the audience is for Roger. Roger talks about digital speed of multi-channel processing and inserted 8 gigabits, not gigabits per second. Could you elaborate, Roger?
I think, if I understand, the 8 gigabytes per second is the rate that we characterize the peak transfer rate across the PCI Express Gen 3 interface. Typically, we are seeing about 80% of that in the best case. We're currently running at 70% of that, about 5.6 gigabytes per second, in an actual functional recording system that uses that same interface. So I believe I've answered your question, I hope so, but that was my reference to 8 gigabytes, and it was the 8 gigabytes per second transfer rate for PCI Express Gen 3.
Thanks, Roger. Next question, this looks like it's addressed to everyone. None of the three strategies presented talked about the use of discrete DSP solutions or multi-core DSP solutions. Is it the opinion of the panel that discrete DSP solutions are no longer suitable for the performance required for unmanned vehicle applications? Why or why not? Who'd like to start on that one?
Well, this is Val, Curtis Wright. From our perspective, it's not necessarily that it's not applicable and it's not going to get any traction in the current applications. It's just for a particular optimization. For example, if you're managing sensors, onboard sensors, there is a processing capability that probably uses a lot of DSP solutions. Once you start streaming the data down to a sensor management unit or a communication downlink, the data is already in a form where you just need to make sure that you have a balance in moving data efficiently versus doing additional level of processing, because then you're not really leveraging other aspects of the architecture.
Anybody else want to jump in and add anything?
Yeah, this is Roger. What we found is we've shifted from DSPs largely to FPGAs for doing the high-speed, compute-intensive tasks. For example, that 3.6 gigahertz digital down converter uses such massive amounts of parallel hardware that it just could not be considered for a discrete DSP device. The other big benefit of FPGAs, of course, is the many different types of interface resources that are all available and are extremely well suited to live streaming high-speed data transfers of many different types in the same device, which is not always the case in a discrete DSP.
David, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I could probably extend that. Talking about, we have a very large focus on GPU computing, and if you look at where the technology's gone, from less than 100 cores just a few years ago to today, we're looking at devices in several hundred cores. And it's a very open and more approachable application development environment. As I discussed in my discussion, the portability of applications in the high-performance computing space down to high-performance embedded computing, there's a lot of portability in the code. There's a lot of CUDA developers, probably OpenCL out there as well. So it's much more of an open, approachable development environment where you get a lot more reuse of applications and probably accelerated development times as well. And we're seeing the GPU technology get very close to what FPGAs can do. They're not quite there yet with things like GPU Direct, and we've just found that it's probably a better applied in this kind of for these kinds of applications.
Thank you, David. Next question is for David. What programming models are people using for multi-core devices?
So I guess I'll speak to the GPU environment again, and it's primarily CUDA today. I mean, we have an internal CUDA expert. There's actually a pretty broad user base of CUDA and folks that understand CUDA out in the market today. It's very mature. It's the market leader, and it's still in great demand and a high level of interest there. OpenCL has the promise of multi-vendor support, but it's not quite as mature as CUDA, and that's where the bulk of our activity is with this particular GPU technology.
I'd like to follow up on that question. Some stories I've written this year, folks were talking how they think OpenCL would be used down the road, especially as ARM gets more embraced in the military world. Are any of you seeing ARM getting implemented? Are you getting any requests from your customers for ARM-based products yet? In military applications?
Yes, we are, and for a couple of reasons. I mean, there's power density. Again, there's a large base of folks that are familiar with the ARM architecture. There's been some discussion internally about the proof of safety capabilities that it potentially brings to applications that have flight safety certifiability issues. I mean, when you're talking about the UAS domain, you're talking about now a payloads and processing that have to do things like sense and avoid. So there has been an uptick in requests and interest in that regard. And we actually have an ARM product both here in this ARM-based Tegra, but also quad ARM processor designs on XMC form factor as well.
Okay. Anybody else have any feelings about ARM in the military? Okay. Next question from the audience. Keep them coming. We've still got a bit more time to answer questions, and these guys are available. Roger, what is the sustained not peak transfer rate across your PCI Express Gen 3 interface?
Okay, well, I did address this actually in my last answer. We are currently running the PCI Express Gen 3 at a 5.6 gigabyte per second in a recording application. We believe we can get to about 6.4, and the reason that we're not getting to the full 8 gigabytes per second, which is the peak data transfer rate, is because there's overhead with protocol to some extent, and then you have to try to keep knocking down each bottleneck as you solve the previous one. So that's where we are. We think we can get to 6.4 in a maximum, in a guaranteed sustained continuous rate.
Okay. Next question. I'm thinking this might be for David. I'm not sure. Have you attempted a Diablo Arch with all flash and memory?
It's probably not for me, but what was the question again?
Have you attempted a Diablo Arch with all flash in memory?
I don't think I can answer that question. I don't understand the question.
Roger or Val?
I'm not familiar with that. This is Roger.
Val, do you know what this question is about?
No.
Okay, we'll pass on that one then. I have a question. Earlier in David's answer, we were talking about OpenCL and development environments, and FPGA still being the choice for a lot of this signal processing. Has it got any easier? Are there any new tools out there to make VHDL programming a little bit easier, or is it still – you got to have those special VHDL jocks in-house to make this work. Roger?
Yes. I think the need for good FPGA designers who can program in VHDL will never go away. What we're seeing is we're seeing some benefits from some of the tools that are emerging now. Typically what we do, though, is we start with a MATLAB model and we go directly to VHDL. We have experimented with some other techniques and found them to be increasingly better as time goes by, and we'll be shifting more towards some of those probably within the next 2 years in a relatively major way. So,
anybody else have anything to add on FPGA programming? Okay, next question from the audience. This one is definitely for David. Any research or applications for micro UAVs? If yet, what is the usual power budget for these micro UAVs? The idea is to be able to budget the power for the extra crypto processing steps.
Ask the question again, John. Sorry.
Sure. Specifically addressed to you. Are there any research or applications for micro UAVs? If yes, what is the usual power budget for these smaller UAVs? The idea is to be able to budget the power for the extra crypto processing steps.
Yeah, so, you know, in the past, actually, we've typically dealt with the Group 2 or Group 3 and higher, not necessarily the micro UAVs. Those typically in the past have been very specialized, purpose-built designs just for that very reason, because they're very dense. They have extremely limited power budgets. We think the Comm Express with the Tegra, you know, even as small as it is in the level of performance it is perhaps even too much for some of the micro UAV. So this is probably a relatively new area for GE, so I'm not quite sure I can address directly what the power budget might be, but the ability to get 300 gigaflops, you know, and potentially in less than 10 watts is pretty compelling, and not quite sure how it fits in with the micro UAVs, because there's quite a few of those designs, and they all have different requirements and payload and range capabilities. So a tough one to answer.
Well, speaking of different types of UAVs and platforms, I know all of you attended the AUVSI Unmanned Systems Show in Orlando earlier this month. What were some of the trends that you saw at the show in terms of platforms, and where the money's going? What are the opportunities going to be for unmanned systems payloads going forward? Is it more small UAVs, more large platforms like Global Hawk or Predator? Any thoughts or anything? Can you share anything that you learned at the event, David?
Well, I think a lot of the ISR is relegated to the Group 4 and Group 5 UAVs. I thought what I observed at the AUVSI was a significant level of activity in the commercial market. And this is primarily, I'm thinking the Group 2, Group 3 UAVs. So you're talking, you know, Predator, Hunter class and below perhaps, but a lot of interest in the commercial market for agriculture, for quarter inspection, for construction site inventory and those kinds of things. So I thought that was very interesting. And of course, these platforms are small. They need a lot of capability on board. And the smaller the form factor, the more performance and the more capability that we can provide them, the more capable these platforms are going to be. And I think we're just beginning to see some of the ways that some of this technology is going to be deployed.
How about you, Roger? Anything? Did you catch anything strike you there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more emphasis on power and weight that I saw. People are trying to get things into a smaller package and have it weigh less. So it's true that people are trying to put more and more function in a given envelope, and for obvious reasons, to make the UAV more, more capable. But what I saw was a lot of interesting new material technology and packaging technology, and also thermal management techniques presented at the show that were quite interesting and innovative, I thought.
Val, were you at the event? Anything you could share or any insights you have from that show?
No, I was not at the event, but I definitely have a perspective from Curtis-Wright. What we see is it kind of segues into another question that I have here about moving to a 3U architecture, but smaller package is definitely something that is prevailing as a trend, and more feature set. So smarter features, that's really where we see, not necessarily raw processing power, but where the raw processing power is required, the distributed functionality is implemented, meaning that you'll have smaller boxes, but now they're going to be distributed in a platform in different locations, clustered for particular functionality and interconnected together through a NetCentric hub, a switch, and essentially achieve very similar functionality of a bigger systems that wouldn't otherwise fit on the smaller platforms.
Val, that sounds like the Victory architecture in some ways that was used developed for ground applications.
It kind of is. You know, it's a twist to it. And, you know, Victory is absolutely more of a ground vehicle technology. But it's kind of a similar, and there is that sense that it's going to lean toward that in a little bit, you know, more rapid fashion than what we saw before. But there is definitely a trend confederating the functionality and distributing different clusters of features around the platforms for obviously swap reasons, is also, and also different flexibility with whatever sensor payload is available and mission profile demands.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, you talked about the 3U architecture, and you're referencing, you kind of answered a question that we have in the audience there on how to minimize swap C and get as much processing as possible in 3U architecture. Is 3U the bottom limit? Are you guys working on smaller form factors for some of these? Because the UAVs are getting smaller, the platforms themselves. So.
Yeah, they are. And we do have different products. So we have 6U, 3U. Obviously, we have something in the PC-104 form factor and some of the smaller packages that are specific. Right now, we don't, you know, see a lot of trending down that path. Obviously, there's some interest in the market base. 3U is probably the most prevalent trend that we currently see. Eventually, as you mentioned, the UAVs will get very small. Potentially, there's going to be a need for something much smaller, system on the chip or ARM-based solution of whatever nature, and that's a possibility.
Next question from the audience. Open architecture, does it also refer to face architecture? I know, David, you've written in our magazine about FACE. Val, do you guys have any comments on that? I think both your companies are involved in the FACE consortium.
Yes, I would say that, the FACE consortium is all about reuse. What they're doing is they're adopting existing open architecture software technologies, if you will. So I think that does play hand in hand. Again, FACE is largely built on existing open architecture standards. That the only area where you have some specificity, I guess, if you will, is at the platform layer, if people are familiar with FACE, but it's largely built on open standards already. And the objective here, of course, is to create that interface layer between those different software capabilities so that you can get applications and other middlewares that become reusable and deployable.
Val, you'd like to add anything to that, or?
From our perspective, it you could see a possible convergence toward the FACE architecture, but in general, it's people try to keep it open, and there are slightly different flavors and interpretations of what open architecture could be. So right now, there's a lot of different flavors that could potentially converge into something that is, you know, phase-based, but at this point, that's where it is.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to go back to something Roger said earlier about a lot of different thermal management techniques, because we keep talking about all this processing performance, and obviously it's generating more heat, and you got to have it up there closer to the sensor because the links to the ground can't handle all that information. So what are some unique things that you guys are doing internally for thermal management? I guess I'm thinking more of what David's company's done. I know he demonstrated some stuff GE was doing, I think it was at last year's event, that GE was doing on thermal management. They were trying to bring over, a different part of GE was doing to try and bring into the Intelligent Platforms Group. Anything you can add on that, David, or thermal management?
Yeah, John, you're probably talking about we were demonstrating something called dual cool jets last year at AUVSI, and this is a technology that comes out of our research center. And actually, that's a substantial benefit to GE Intelligent Platforms that we can reach back into our research center and our 1,500 PhDs there. Millions of dollars spent on some advanced thermal management technologies that we are actually beginning to incorporate into some of our products. You know, for instance, when you talk about GPUs, very high thermal density, there's a lot of power there, and you want to be able to run these in the box in challenging environments to the maximum speed that the device can operate. And we're actually now able to do that because we've got technologies that create very intimate contact between a die and any kind of heat spreader technology, then into the chassis, and then being able to build a box that's got very high performance, but use technologies that eliminate the need for fans. And there's constant investment being made. There's some very interesting technologies that are actually relatively mature. I mean, Tierra level 5, 6, and 7 today that we'd love to talk to customers about because they. The thermal technologies apply at the die interface, how we're spreading the heat, how you get the heat off the boards of the chassis, how you move the heat off the chassis, and there's some very interesting things coming up that are relatively game changing in the market. So last year it was dual cool jets. It's very interesting. If people want to Google it, you can Google dual cool jets, and you'll see all kinds of information out there. About what GE's done with that, how it's deployed, the YouTube videos and everything. It's quite interesting.
Hey, Val, thank you, David. And I'm not going to try and say Google dual cool really fast. Val, can you talk a little bit about what Curtis Wright's doing, anything unique there on the thermal management side?
From our perspective, the airflow through technology is something that some of the people might have seen it, but that's something that we are leading fairly strongly on. It allows us to dissipate a lot of power in a fairly compact package. If some folks recall from a beginning slides of my presentation, there are a couple of systems that are pretty heavy very high processing capability. And they dissipate in the order of 2,000, 3,000 watts in a fairly small package, and that's only achievable through the use of the airflow through technology that we have implemented on the chassis. The other techniques that we use are, depending again on the size and some replacement of the particular system, would be fanless chimney type of the approach, or liquid cooling, or could be potentially tapping into some of the cold plate or conductive cooling techniques, and obviously adding some smarts into the software, doing a dynamic power management. That's something that is also is definitely implemented in a lot of our systems, and specifically on things where you could potentially put a nice cooling feature on the chassis, but when UAV is exposed to a very cold environment, you really don't want to cool it more. So there's some smarts associated with how you manage that as well that we have in our end products.
Thank you. Roger, anything you'd like to add on thermal management, anything catch your eye at the show? Or anything
I was kind of intrigued by some of the new crystalline carbon composite materials that have a unidirectional or longitudinal thermal conductivity that's between 2 and 3 times that of copper, but at extremely lightweight compared to copper. So these types of innovative materials and techniques are going to be required as we go forward, because the devices will still continue to dissipate heat no matter what they are, and they still need to be that heat needs to be directed to a surface that that can accept it. So that was one that kind of stood out for me in the show.
Okay. Thanks, gentlemen. Got a question here from the audience for Roger. Are Vita 66.4 optical backplanes and cables available yet?
They're just starting to become available. There is not what I would call an infrastructure yet. The Vita 66.4 standard has not yet been ratified, so it is early. We're finding a lot of interest in this new technology, again, primarily for the benefits of very long distance, very high speed, very lightweight data transmission, which has some tremendous benefits, especially for unmanned vehicles. And so we expect that standard to be ratified soon. In the meantime, we've got working prototype systems So the technology is valid. It's just got to be go through the standards, and then we've got to get our government customers to believe in it and start doing some procurements.
Thanks, Roger. Question here for David French. Don't GPUs introduce large latencies into the processing chain?
Yeah, I touched on this a little bit earlier. It's a technology. It's GPU-direct RDMA, and this significantly reduces the latency, and it does that by bypassing the main processor and enabling direct access to memory by the graphics processor. So a GPU can now write in and out of main memory without going through the main processor. It's not quite to the level of FPGAs, but it is close enough in many applications, and the trade-off in many cases support the GPU architecture because of that GPU direct capability. So there's been some strides made. A few years ago, there was a challenge. It did introduce some latency, but GPU direct RDMA is closing that gap significantly.
Thank you, David. You know, there's one thing all of you have in common, and that's you supply off-the-shelf COTS or TRL-level products for these digital signal processing ISR applications. And there's been a lot in the press the last couple of years about sequestration, budget cuts, et cetera. You all had good events earlier this month at the Unmanned Systems Show. So where do you see the market going for COTS providers? Is it more about TRL, as David talked about earlier, or is it more because people cut back, how they look more toward improving their signal processing applications? Are they going to turn more toward outsourcing this technology as opposed to doing it in-house, which some companies, some primes still do? Where do you see the market going for off-the-shelf ISR processing systems? Start with Roger.
Okay, yes, we definitely do see some companies who have been forced to cut staff are more interested in procuring a system-level solution rather than a board-level solution or a subsystem-level solution. So we might sell to a customer a recording subsystem as opposed to a collection of boards that would then need to be integrated by the customer. So we're definitely seeing that. We're also seeing that that customers are becoming, trying to become more efficient in terms of what functionality are they getting for a particular system so that it can be versatile and can be adapted through either FPGA reconfiguration or software reprogrammability so that it can adapt to kind of a shifting landscape of requirements that come along without having to impose a complete redesign for the end customer, because they know that the end customer is increasingly cost sensitive.
Okay. Val, you want to take it next?
Yeah, from our perspective, we see a lot of leading toward 80% solution. A lot of inquiries about tell me what you have, tell me what the highest TRL you have, what something that is not going to go obsolete over the next couple of years. What does it do? What kind of features does it have? Can we implement this or that? But it's going away from the 100% compliance solution and more of 80% solution. There's also that convergence, as was mentioned earlier, to have something flexible that could be applied on this program and adjacent program and another program. It's an easier sell. And again, in our market base, one of the biggest competitors is actually our customers. So it's something that they do hold dear to themselves as sequestration and the budgetary cuts are more and more prevalent. They tend to keep it in-house, and there's less work out there being outsourced to the second-tier suppliers. And in some cases, this is buy versus make decision. And unfortunately, in some events, they decide to keep it in-house.
Thank you. David, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, thanks, John. Yeah, definitely we see a trend toward outsourcing some of the capabilities because of a reduction in resources internally. And I think what some of our customers seem to be focused on is buying what's standard and common. And when you talk about single-board computers, things like I.O., switching, there is a notable trend toward more highly integrated solutions, even at the black box level. But But on the same token, if that particular integrated platform doesn't fit, there's still a demand for high TRL. The government really doesn't want to spend money unless it's high TRL. There's a lot of talk about lowest price technically acceptable, and that's a challenge. And I think, you know, to Roger's point, you know, the customers are getting more savvy on the technology. They've been very careful to design their systems for upgradability. They're paying attention to what the profiles are of the boards they're building to make sure they're not, you know, locking in any particular vendor perhaps. So they're being very careful about that and very adamant about open architecture. If there's one piece of the design that requires some custom software, that's kind of a no-no in our customers' mind. So, you know, GE strives to be as open as possible using standard middleware, standard software, and making sure that the designs that we build will support that openness in the software domain.
Okay, thank you. That brings us right up to our time limit for today. I'd like to thank Val Zaroff, David French, and Roger Hosking for speaking, and Curtis Wright Defense Solutions, GE Intelligent Platforms, and Pentek for sponsoring today's event. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.